Let me begin with first a note of modesty. I think it's probably an accurate statement that everybody in this room knows more about the Middle East than I do. But that's what makes us useful, valuable to me. To continue a process of dialogue, of consultation with regional and functional specialists, to both stimulate thinking on your part, provide ideas to us as we think about the future, think about what to focus on, what we should collect, what kind of analytic cadre we should build. And in some respects, this is a continuation of the roughly year and a half process that resulted in the preparation and later this week the publication of Global Trends 2025. That we've engaged literally hundreds of people around the world in this process and solicitation of ideas. What did they think the world was going to look like? What did they fear that the world would look like? What did they wish it to look like? What did they think would cause the more unpleasant, negative, fearsome trajectories to come about? What did they think would be contributing to the more positive scenarios or trajectories from their perspective? And what did they think the United States was going to do? Since this is prepared under the auspices of the National Intelligence Council, it would be inappropriate, some would say illegal, for us to look very closely at the United States. That's beyond our writ. One correction to Matt's introduction. This is not a declassified study. It was prepared from the beginning as an unclassified study, and there is no sort of classified annex or version that when we issue it, what you see is what there is of it. And on the website, we will have some of the materials that were assembled, seminars, conferences, deliberations, expert background papers that were prepared and contributed to this effort. Today, I'm not going to give you a preview of that study. I'm going to draw upon elements of that study, subset of them, and make some observations about the part of the world you know better than I, really to sort of create a version of the strategic thinking, the dialoguing process, the challenging of assumptions, but what about statements that we anticipate receiving, so that you will be a part of the process as a contributor as well as possibly a beneficiary to it. Neither the 2025 paper, this is about 100 pages, nor my presentation should be viewed as a prediction of the world. Even the word projection is a little more determinative than we intend this to be. We've got four scenarios. We've got a number of drivers or factors that we think will contribute to the shaping of events. By themselves, they're inadequate. And for those of you who read the Global Trends 2020, this is not an effort to update that study or push it out 5 years further, although it does take a time frame 5 years further out, that we didn't mechanically take a new look at the same factors or drivers or variables. Some of them, like globalization, persist. Others, like energy and demography, we looked at more closely this time than we did last time. Again, this is not a prediction. It's to stimulate strategic thinking. The setup for both today's presentation and 2020 is to identify some of the relative certainties about the world and some of the truly as yet undetermined factors that will we know they will influence. How they will influence is a matter of leadership decisions, is a matter of the interplay of the separate variables. For example, climate change. That earlier this year we did a classified look at geopolitical implications of climate change. The substance of that was conveyed in unclassified testimony available. Points I'd make here are by 2030, the time frame of the climate change, 2025 in this one, we're beginning to see some effects of climate change. And this is one where, according to the scientists, not us, we're not the ones making the scientific judgment, that the die has already been cast for climate change out to 2025 or 2030. That steps can, arguably should be taken now, but they won't have effect to beyond 2030, at least according to the scientific folks we consulted. So the effects are more or less a given. The actions that will be taken by governments, the policy decisions, the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of those efforts to moderate, prevent, or in some ways shape the impacts of climate change are yet to be determined. The world that we envision for 2025, we're characterizing as incompletely transformed. Now, that may sound like the ultimate cop-out. It'll be different than today, but we don't know exactly what it's going to be in 2025. But it's an important point. We envision the unfolding of the issues, demographic, energy, technological change, transfer of wealth from west to east, among others, as having an impact and changing the way the world does business, the way issues are defined and resolved, but that the shortcomings of the current international order, largely developed in the aftermath of World War II. International institutions, IMF, World Bank, and so on, the United Nations and specialized organizations, being increasingly incapable of managing tomorrow's problems. Designed for a different time and place, there are many who have a significant vested interest in the status quo because as nations or as corporations or other actors, they benefit from it. But that the adaptation to a new future will still be in a state of flux is what we're anticipating. So as we think about this with respect to the Middle East, it's not in terms of a new global order with new or transformed or rejuvenated institutions with new instruments of global governance, that we will have a fair degree of adaptation, improvisation, multiple channels for managing the problems. And that probably is going to make it more difficult for specific countries and regions and problems countries and regions to address specific problems because the landscape will be shifting. Shifting to the Middle East here, more specifically. As in 2020, we see the Middle East as at the center of an arc of instability. That it's, if one looks at the globe as a whole, the Middle East, really from the Maghreb across into Central Asia, is one in which almost every problem that will challenge political leadership anywhere on the globe is to be found there, and many at a higher degree of severity or intensity. And indeed, it is the multiplicity of serious challenges that may be a defining characteristic of the region, that the ability to cope with any one problem being affected, being made more complicated, more challenging, because of the interaction of the problems, the need to address many simultaneously, that actions taken on one will almost automatically affect the decision space and opportunities for managing the rest. Where one cuts in will make a difference. Demographic dimensions. We pay attention to demography in this, that the world will increase by about 1.4 billion people, demographers tell us. Only 3% of that growth will be in the United States, Europe, Japan, the developed world. The rest is in Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, or Central America. And the demographic dimensions and challenges in the Middle East will be among the most significant. A youth bulge that has the complicating factor of a very large segment of the population with raging hormones that sort of an age where challenges to authority are the norm, with views shaped by the global communications revolution, sort of knowing what is happening around the world, elsewhere in the country, the ability to communicate with one another very, very quickly, meaning that everything from notices to go to a rally to the spread of an absolutely unfounded rumor about what is alleged to have happened will be greeted with all of the discriminating thought that one can anticipate from a youthful population. But it's not a completely negative aspect. That looking at the region as a whole, the age structure will be roughly the same as that of Taiwan or South Korea at the time that it began. Each of them began their sort of industrial takeoff, economic takeoffs. The dependency ratios will be pretty good. There'll be a large working age population with a relatively small burden of senior citizens to support. And as one moves through the period between now and 2025, again, the projections are that the population growth rates will go down, so there'll be fewer dependents at the bottom. So there'll be at least a potentially mobilizable workforce to move the region away from its heavy dependence on commodities, primarily oil and gas, in the Middle East. But that has requisites. Education. A big challenge that, again, as you know better than I think a fair characterization overall is that the education capacity, education performance for most of the citizenry is inadequate. Not preparing people for today's jobs, let alone tomorrow's jobs. The youth bulge means that the challenge gets bigger and bigger. The cost, the need for teachers, the need for facilities expands because the number requiring an education goes up. So a hard problem compounded by growth in numbers. There are the aspects of unequal access, male-female, the gender gap in much of the region. A significant portion of the population, you know, those of the female persuasion, that don't get the same kind of education as available to males. So if sort of the full capacity is to be tapped, you have to move males up a lot, but you've got to move females up more in this. And the benefits, again, global capacities of female education on stability, development, tolerance, how resources are allocated within governmental structure are quite noticeable, quite notable, and mostly beneficial. So will that happen? Can that happen? Both the challenge and the potential are there. Another element that comes out of the demographic portion of the equation are demands made on the political system. It's not just that the youthful segment of the population is sort of less respectful, less willing to accept things as they are. The exposure to communications, what is available elsewhere, their own expectations. And I'll come back to this later, some of the challenges that come out of climate change, some of the challenges that come out of global economic developments, they're going to want more from governments than simply being left alone. That the demands for performance that we levied by the population on the governments are almost certain to go up. Whether the capacity of the regimes goes up commensurately is at least an open question. But that whatever might be required to enhance performance today, delivery of good services, meeting expectations of a wide variety, is going to go up, not just because of bigger numbers, but because of higher expectations. And the pressures on regimes of all kinds to be more accountable to their citizens. It's not just an aspect of democratic or democratizing regimes where elected officials are more accountable to their constituencies. The observed phenomenon globally is that even authoritarian regimes or more authoritarian regimes feel compelled to take into account citizen concerns, complaints, expectations, demands, sort of the street matters more. And that will be a factor in individual countries in this region, it seems to us. I mentioned dependence on oil and gas. And commodities more generally. And as one looks out to 2025, one can project continued rise of China, India, Brazil, the rising powers, large populations, tremendous requirement for energy, keeping demand and prices up for a very long time. Money continues to pour into the region. That gives a certain cushion and capacity to any of the regimes that have these resources to sort of buy off demands for perhaps more fundamental change. But the very high prices that we saw not that long ago, and increased attention to alternatives to oil and gas that we've experienced before in the early 70s, the late 70s, that it may be that the world is more serious this time about actually finding alternatives. Now, whether or not those alternatives can be fully realized, put in place in 25 years, or by 2025, is somewhere between uncertain and unlikely. It takes a long time to put in place a replacement technology. But at the margins, it could begin to have a to make a difference, and could begin to affect price, earnings, and the benefits that flow therefrom. So this is one that can go either of two ways, or anywhere in the middle, from the country, the region continues to trade on its most abundant and most lucrative resource, obtaining a cushion that obviates the needs for fundamental changes in other areas, or a wise leadership, again, in specific countries, can say, this is likely to be a short-term windfall opportunity that we better act sooner rather than later to capitalize on. If we act on it sooner rather than later, may have a comparative advantage in terms of attracting investment, creating a better educated workforce, and so forth. And that, I think the worst assumption would be that all states in the region react, in all states with oil and gas in the region react in exactly the same way, that there's likely to be a variable picture, but I leave it to you to speculate on which one is likely to be more aggressive and which ones are likely to be more complacent about the situation. Regardless of the specific price of hydrocarbons, the global situation, again, not limited to the Middle East, is one where we envision continuing transfers or shifting of wealth from west to east. The oil and gas rich countries, not just in the Middle East, Russia, Venezuela, Nigeria, continuing to have large amounts of money. The East Asian industrial, the manufacturing that results in a large shift of wealth will, again, change relative interests and capacities to do things. Sovereign wealth funds. That in some respects, sovereign wealth funds are, you know, similar to the windfall oil profits of the 70s, the Japanese bubble economy of the 80s, but are in different places and different orders of magnitude here. And regardless of specific judgments about how much more money or how much less money flows into these funds, that's money to be available for investment. That in the past, one could assume that that money would flow in significant portions to the United States and Western Europe. Probably not a safe assumption for the future, at least in order to manage how much of it, particularly the sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf, will be reinvested in the region. Is there an attraction, is there an incentive to invest at home, closer to home, to reduce uncertainty, reduce instability because it's the right thing to do? Or is this an economic decision? As you invest money where you're going to make money. If the region does not look like the most favorable one, either for investment from within the region or from outside, it will affect the relative standing of again, individual countries and the region as a whole vis-a-vis other parts of the world. I mentioned climate change. Again, without going into any detail on this, that everything that we have looked at in the conversations indicates that water shortages and high-cost food could well be a significant factor by 2025. And portions of the region are the most vulnerable or among the most vulnerable to water shortages. And competition for water, competition for agricultural land, like competition for other resources that may become scarcer with industrialization rates of growth, again, outside of the region, that could add a kind of competition to the international system that we really haven't seen for a very long time, resource competition. Again, we stick with water. If water is a problem today, it'll be a bigger problem in locations that are a problem today by 2025. A bigger problem for governments to deal with, a more demanding population. That seems to me will have to be on the agenda that leaders inside and outside of the region have to grapple with. Another dimension that we can assume will be there is the nuclear one. Whether this is a nuclear arms race in the region and could be triggered by what happens in Iran. By 2025, the issues of today will, in one way or another, be resolved. It clearly makes a difference how it is resolved. And whether there is a control regime, collaboration, cooperation, and so forth, or a regional arms race, or a control regime or an arms race that draws outside powers into the region in a way that is different from the past. There's the nuclear power dimension of this. Again, rising oil and gas prices, if that's the scenario, that in much of the world will make nuclear power more attractive. It means spread of nuclear technology. It means need to safeguard those facilities. It means perhaps capability for desalination to address the water problem. That there are a range of issues around nuclear power, both for civilian use and weaponization, that are likely to play out in this region. This is part of your terrorism series of seminars. And terrorism, at least as a potential problem, will clearly still be there in this region, in part as the instrument of the weak against the strong. That if government responses to problems, pressures, demands are such that social dissatisfaction inclines a segment, could be a small segment of the population, to take action to force the governments to behave differently, to change priorities, allocate resources differently, sort of historically resort to terrorism, should be expected, putting yet more demands on the regimes and putting into a different kind of profile relationship of the governments to the outside protectors who have been interested in oil and gas, who may not be so interested depending on what the alternative technologies are, who may not wish to be vulnerable or may have a NIMBY problem. We sure would like you in the region to maintain stability, but not in my country, thank you, because that increases the unpopularity, if not the threats to my government. If one extrapolates from the demography, you know, again, all of these young, possibly alienated people, some subset, probably a small subset, will be available for recruitment to a cause, whatever the cause. Again, a subset of it might be interested in terror. We did not look at the ideological appeal or the lack thereof of Al-Qaeda. Had we done so, the extrapolation of a declining appeal, where they've got a program that doesn't have a great appeal in the region, that sort of what they are for doesn't have a great deal of resonance. I think we would anticipate that would continue. But again, the specifics that have given rise to Hezbollah, Hamas, Pidge, and other groups will clearly be a function, as they have been, of developments in the region. Final point that I'd like you to consider, and again, this is all building to the dialogue, where I won't have the answers, you will have the questions, and that will be the a success of the effort. But the final point concerns alternative models. That one of the phenomena of recent decades, particularly since the demise of the Soviet Union, has been the appeal of the Washington Consensus model. More or less liberal democratic regimes with market economies and the requisites to make that work. But the rising powers here, specifically or particularly China, but to some extent also Russia, arguably have an alternative model here. It's not so democratic, a larger role for state, larger role for state capitalism, that the Middle East is a region that, like Africa and a lot of other places, sort of historically made the wrong choice in the 50s and 60s for the centralized authoritarian model of development and paid a price. Now, a variant or an alternative to the Washington Consensus in the short term, but a short term that now, in the case of China, now extends over decades, may have some appeal. Can it work as well in the region with very, very different kind of traditions, populations, expectations, relationships to authority as it has in China and Russia? But there may well be an alternative model. And as an alternative, if or to the extent that alternative model is pursued in some countries in the region, it could alter intra-regional relationships and relationships with outside powers. I'm sure I have dissatisfied anyone who came looking for the crystal ball take on the region. But if I have left you with a lot of questions and a lot of, yeah, but you forgot, then it's been successful from my point. And why don't I throw this open to your take on the region in 2025.